Sligro Tool podcast is sponsored by Queen's University Belfast. Researchers at Queen's are at the heart of supporting global efforts to understand the coronavirus. To discover more about their research, please visit qub.ac.uk.
Welcome to the Sligro Tool in Conversation podcast. My name is Brian O'Neill, and my guest today is Dr. John Moriarty. John is a fellow in the Centre for Evidence and Social Innovation at Queen's University, and he is also a sociology lecturer at Queen's as well. John, thanks very much for being on the show today.
Thank you, Brian.
So I would imagine for a researcher or academic, COVID is kind of like the ultimate case study, because we seem to have a whole new way of working thrust upon us within a very short space of time. So are you interested? Are you watching closely how all this pans out?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's a complete... what would you call it, disruptor, paradigm change. So for anyone who's interested in work and the work that we do and how we organize our lives around work, it has been a fascinating period. It is also, and a time where we kind of have to adjust a lot of what we think to be normal or conventional wisdom or understood basic principles, because the impact on work and on industry and the economy is just so profound that I think we'll be we will I think eventually refer to a pre-COVID moment and a post-COVID world, even in the scenario where a COVID vaccine will adjust things in terms of how we can organize society. I think so much has changed in people's lives in this lockdown period. That will really feed into what becomes normal in the future.
Yeah, what I find most interesting about it is kind of like how inertia plays a role in human psychology and organizational psychology, in that I've been using the web now for, 25 years. So we've had like video conferencing, we've had all these tools before, and they've been around for a while. But people didn't really embrace them too much, you know, because people kind of don't really like change, and they don't really like, you know, a new ways of working. So it was interesting how when people are forced to change, like literally within a week or two, that it's incredible how you can go from one adopting all these new technologies and new ways of working.
Absolutely. That's such an important point, that like doing things the way we always did them, and doing things that are familiar, is such a huge part of how we organize things. Even just taking this conversation that we're having today, I mean, had we been having this conversation in January, it's very possible I would have made my way across Belfast. We would have been sitting in the one room. I might have gotten up on my bike, so I probably would have burned a few extra calories. Or if it was raining really hard, I might have gotten in my car and emitted a little bit of extra carbon into the atmosphere, and it probably wouldn't have occurred to us when we're not physically that far distant to do this thing remotely and to conduct the interview in the same way that you conducted your interview last week with your contributor from Texas. So basically to treat us all as if we're interacting on a long distance basis. And when you start to think out from the implications of that, I mean, if I'd made that journey, how many shops and business would I have passed? You know, how would it, you know, if I needed to repair my bike, could I have just called into a shop? You know, I would have basically organized my entire economic life around physical proximity to things and people. And when you take that principle of proximity away and you actually invert it and say, well, actually, we can't be proximal to one another anymore, we have to really rethink what we think of as an economy. And as you say, that goes for individual behavior as well. You know, we will be rethinking, and we have been rethinking, you know, is it professional, if you like, to be having a conversation, you know, as part of one's work in one's spare room with the wallpaper the way it is behind you, and so on. And it has just been really interesting watching people adapt and, as you say, realize some of the opportunities that technology has, but also realize some of the values and some of what people were getting out of their daily routine that maybe they didn't appreciate in the past.
Yeah, because I think it's, I mean, I've always worked from home, so for me a lot of this stuff isn't actually too new. I mean, Daisy is, we have a 5-year-old and he's off school, so that was the biggest challenge, you know, kind of homeschooling and minding him. But as far as work-wise, I mean, I was all set up already, you know, for working from home. But I know for a lot of people, if you're new to it, it can be quite a strange experience, because I find it unusual the way, like, a lot of friends of mine are still kind of keeping to the same work structure and working the same hours. Because I always think, like, me personally, because I'm self-employed, I will only work probably 3 or 4 hours solid work a day, because I know normally in a job, that's all you ever get done. The rest of the time is meetings and interruptions and chats and, you know, arsing around the internet. And so if you can actually get a solid block done, and I kind of worry that a lot of people are kind of trying to do too much. Do you know what I mean? When work from home, they're trying to, like, cram everything, work as they were before, work longer. Actually, I would actually say than ever working in offices.
I think you're absolutely right, right? So 9 to 5 is a really interesting phenomenon in and of itself, because it's something that we've maintained into the 21st century, even though it's really a creation of the factory-dominated era of industrial production, and the idea that you can just break 24 hours into 3 8-hour shifts. And when you're thinking about a factory floor, you can quite easily equate time with productivity, because if people are just doing repetitive tasks, then the longer they do them, the more tasks they get through. But we know that now a lot of modern work, as you say, involves a lot of breaks. Sometimes you can have one productive hour in the day, or one productive half hour, or the article that you spend half an hour writing for Slugger might be better than the one you spent 5 hours toiling over the previous day. So that equation between time and productivity is gone. And actually, as I think you're kind of alluding to, there is now some research that suggests that you can spend too much time on things, that it can become counterproductive at a certain point, because you're not allowing basically your brain to process things where it needs rest. So if you keep throwing yourself in an effortful way at a task, you're not necessarily improving the quality of what you're doing. So yeah, you're right. I think this moment again has made people think about, well, okay, if I have to balance childcare and a job, and we now live in this world of a lot of two income households, so a lot of people are doing, well, so my wife and I are doing this shift pattern where one of us will work a morning and do child, and the other one will do childcare, and then we swap around. And like, neither of our employers has said your productivity has shot down, and I think we would generally say we're probably doing okay in terms of productivity, and I think a lot of people are having this experience. What I also think is going on is, because people don't have to make the effort to get to the place they used to work, a lot of people don't. So they're not sitting in traffic for as long, they're not spending as long getting parked, they're not spending as long getting ready in the morning. They feel that there's extra time and extra energy, and that automatically the best thing to do is to reinvest that into their work. So people do sometimes end up working longer because they feel like they can, or they always felt like the workday was too short. I think if we carry on with this pattern of people working between office and home, that we'll start to reach an equilibrium where people start to realize there's an optimal work pattern for each job, and it isn't necessarily the same for every job, and it isn't necessarily just more time equals more stuff done.
Yeah, because I think what people are realizing is that the issue is not people skiving or not working. The issue sometimes is people overworking and not taking proper rest and kind of work intruding into family life, you know, especially if you don't have a proper home office and you're working from the kitchen with small kids running around underneath your feet. So that's, I think sometimes there's a risk, I think, of people kind of burning themselves out, you know, trying to do too much during all this.
Yeah, I also think there's a big risk of people sort of internalizing the entire economic crisis, and particularly maybe people who don't have kids, or people who have bigger homes and have office space, and they see, they're trying to interact with their colleagues who have kids running around, or who might, you know, not have the space in the house to create, you know, a dedicated workspace. And then those people who feel like they have more kind of bandwidth and time and space feel like they have to proportionally carry the burden. And I think just generally one of the things that fascinates me about work in general is how it teaches us to internalize other people's values. So we learn to kind of assimilate what a company and a group of individuals expects from us, and we call that our role. And then very often then when people ask us, how are we doing in our jobs, we'll reflect on the things that other people expect of us rather than the things that we want ourselves, and the things that drive and motivate us, and what make us feel like we're doing good in our lives. So this is another moment where people have to make an adjustment of like, well, okay, work has radically changed. The economy is under threat. How do I respond to that? And how is that partly my responsibility? And I think in a couple of years' time, when we reflect and we have some more data and more information about how people responded, I think we will find that people, that this was a crisis that people took quite personally.
In a sense, the 2008 crash and crisis was so abstract. It was, you know, things losing value that people couldn't necessarily see. And of course, eventually some companies started to suffer and some people's mortgages started to suffer, but it happened quite slowly, whereas this happened quite suddenly and was so pervasive and affected everybody's life and could be seen so visually by people. So I really do think this, this one will be a game changer in a way that previous crises maybe haven't.
Yeah. A lot of your research is around mental health and work. Even before this crisis, there was kind of two major issues I see with kind of like a lot of work, especially like knowledge work, first one is it's everlasting. For a lot of jobs, there's no obvious finish line. So you're in a factory making cars, you know, you go in, you make four cars or whatever it is, you go home, you forget about it. Whereas a lot of knowledge work, it's kind of ongoing, it's continuous, like you're be researching or writing articles, and it's like a constant stream almost. And then you get this kind of like, because you can now work from anywhere by carrying a smartphone, you could be working at home, you could be working queuing for the coffee shop, you could be working, you know, having your out for a meal, that in some ways there's no escape from work, you know, that kind of demarcation is now gone. And how do you think that is kind of affecting kind of people's kind of mental health and the ability not to switch off?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. So I think those are all huge issues. The always on culture, so part of why it's not necessarily productive to be throwing time at things constantly is like, that's energy that people are taking up. That's emotional energy. And I think we underplay the role of emotion in work. We maybe it hasn't, you know, been a major story of in economics or in the story of capitalism, but a huge part of this modernity era that we're in, where a lot of stuff is produced far away, and then a lot of work amounts to kind of managing people and managing wealth to an extent as well, and people don't necessarily have a tangible, you know, connection to the outcomes of their work. So a lot of it becomes imagined, and so we've started to hear a change in how companies talk and project, where they talk about they're really interested in talent, they're really interested in passion. They want, you know, often passion will appear in job descriptions and job advertisements. So they want people who are emotionally invested, and they're in their work doing kind of, you know, sort of living their dream or fulfilling some personal set of goals and values and ambition. And all of that, you know, is great in some ways, but is like exhausting and taxing in lots of other ways. And I think part of the sort of impact that work has on mental health now is just the amount of time that people are spending reading one another's cues, one another's emotions, decoding all of that, you know, really complex information, and feeding it back against, well, you know, am I doing good in the world? Am I doing something that's satisfying to me? Am I actually achieving what's expected of me? So the always on, the having the mobile phone there as a constant sort of tie, that anchoring people to work, and the fact that it, you know, you felt it vibrate, so you know that there's an email, you know that could have been your boss. I think that takes away some of the time that, you know, we should really be using to do some kind of deeper processing and relaxation, and connect to the many other strands of life, family life, community involvement, physical activity. So much of our work is kind of cerebral, and we don't use all of our bodies in our work. So that's taking us away from those other important moments.
That's good, because I mean, I think what people don't really realize is that the mind and the body need rest. I mean, you'll probably know this concept of the default mode network on the brain, which essentially says that during downtime and quiet time, the kind of brain uses that time to kind of organize thoughts and store memories and all the rest. And if you're not giving the brain any time to switch off, you know, you're just feeding it the kind of constant noise that it can never really process. And that's just why we end up with these kind of scatterbrained reflexes that are just kind of firing all over the place from one tweet to the next, really.
Yeah, and even people going all the way up to the point at which they fall asleep, essentially on, just means they aren't even fully at rest when they're asleep, and are switching straight back on when they wake up. So as you say, like, our rest isn't just the time when our eyes are closed and our consciousness switches to sleep. You know, rest is supposed to be sort of a gradual change of state over the course of the day. We won't know for a long time. You know, I mean, we're talking about, we won't know about the impact of COVID for a long time, because it's still happening now, and the social impacts of it are still revealing themselves to us now. But the smartphone era is still very young. You know, we're only talking about, I mean, I show my students a chart of internet usage, and the point at which most internet usage switched from PCs to mobile phones is only in the last sort of 6 or 7 years, as smartphone usage has increased. So that's like we're still at kind of year zero of that era of technology and of connectivity, and we don't know what impact it's going to have on us in the long term. I think as individuals, we need to be monitoring how much we're wedded to that, and how much we're allowing that shape our experience.
So during the work from home, I mean, there's kind of a lot of utopian talk about people working from home more, and less commuting, and, you know, better for the environment and all that type of stuff. But what a lot of people are saying, like, is they're kind of going insane, stuck in the house, and they kind of miss the social aspect of work, and they kind of miss, I mean, commuting is obviously a pain, but some friends tell me, well, like, it takes me half an hour to go home, but during that half an hour, I kind of decompress, you know, I kind of forget about work, I can chill out and listen to some music or a podcast or whatever. And so a lot of people are kind of missing these kind of, like, the social side, you know, to it. So I suppose it'll probably not go one extreme or another. We'll end up with people maybe working from home 1 or 2 days a week, into the office for a few days. I mean, is that the way you kind of see it kind of panning out?
So, yeah, I see the acceptance of remote working, now that we've all had to accept it, I think the general acceptance of one or two people calling into a meeting, that not being seen as an exceptional thing to accommodate in a lot of workplaces, where previously, if there was a meeting on, you know, unless you have a reason not to be there, the expectation is that you're physically there, so you make the energy output and the investment to actually physically be there. I see the tolerance for remote engagement, particularly when it comes to things like international travel. But it is interesting to reflect on, like, why. I mean, it's, I say, okay, smartphones and web conferencing and so on are relatively new, or it's new that we've had the degree of connectivity and strength of internet to support it. But, like, the ability to teleconference, as it were, you know, to meet remotely, like, that's not all that new. But the in-person meeting, whether it's between two people or multiple people, has been very resilient to technological changes. People have still wanted to cross great distances to meet in person. And I think you're alluding to the reason to that, for that, which is that, one, you know, we actually like people. You know, we're, you know, on average, people get energy from other people, and get, you know, nourishment and warmth and empathy and human connection. It's kind of one of the reasons we do a lot of this work collectively, is to maintain that, you know, that physical, that full body embodied connection with one another. Also, in terms of intelligence and productivity, we get a lot of information from one another's physical presence. Okay, I can see a two-dimensional picture of you as we talk, and I can actually see myself, which it would be unusual for an in-person meeting as well. But, you know, in a room, you know, you'd get a fuller sense of somebody's body language. I express myself a lot with my hands, and sometimes the text of what I say doesn't make an awful lot of sense when I listen to it back or read it back. But what the point I've been making in a room is often, you know, through making eye contact or through gestures, and replacing that isn't straightforward at all, and there will be something lost. And I think one of the risks then is that if there's people who, because of circumstances, are able to get back into physical proximity with their colleagues more quickly than others, and some people are going to become the dial-in colleagues, while other people become the in-person colleagues. It's kind of in microcosm a version of what some outsource companies experience, where the people who dial in from a distance feel like they're disconnected from the center of power and the real decision making, because once they press the red button and they hang up, they no longer have access to the people in the room who, as they walk out to the room to the water cooler, continue the conversation, continue the connection. So there are risks, even though I do think it will be more common. We have to be really conscious about the implications it has for how we work together as collectives.
I think that there could be an upside in that once you strip away the kind of politics of the office, in terms of, you know, in every organization there's kind of like, you know, the bootlickers and the kind of the people that kind of seem to spend more hours smoozing than doing work. And okay, once you strip away all that and you're just judging people on the quality of the work, then there is an argument to say that that has implications in terms of reducing inequality and making it more level playing field. Do you know what I'm kind of getting at? So it's kind of less kind of you're kind of being judged on the work itself, because that's kind of, that's the only thing you can see essentially.
It's a really interesting question as to whether this could have an impact on inequality, or on, I would say more broadly, kind of power dynamics within organizations. And it's an interesting question of, like, what do, if people were kind of, you know, using what, you know, what we might say kind of cultural capital, or using the force of their personality to be the main part of their work, and, you know, being seen to be, you know, socially connected and using those kind of skills, and those are skills. If they don't have the same outlet for those skills, well, you know, what happens to them, or what happens to their trajectory, or does it become a little bit more? So I hesitate with the word meritocratic, but more based on, as you say, more tangible outputs that people can measure in workplaces, and more hard and fast metrics of performance. And undoubtedly, whatever new pattern we settle into, organizations will find a way to, you know, assign value to different people's performance and different people's roles, and everyone is going to have to adapt. I think by and large, in this conversation, we've been mainly talking about how people's, you know, their personal productivity is going to be impacted. But as you say, that, you know, you'd have to think that some people who work kind of more privately or like to kind of work, you know, plow their own furrow a bit, that they still gain something from the role of people who are more collaborative or more effusive. So yeah, no, it's a really interesting question that I don't have a really snappy answer to.
So what? Because I studied management at Queen's myself, and I've kind of worked in a lot of organizations over the years. What I always find interesting is that in a lot of organizations, there's almost there's people who actively work to stop other people working. Okay, now maybe not consciously, but you have like a whole level kind of almost like mid managers who's management. Management's one of those things, people are kind of given the task without actually having any particular training or aptitude for the job. So they just spend a lot of their time interrupting people who are trying to get on with the actual work. And then you have like this whole kind of level of administrators, which you'll be familiar with working on the university. And it's almost like they may not, in theory, they're there to kind of assist and help, but in some ways they just kind of seem to create more and more work and more admin work for the people who are actually working. And so you kind of have, so if you strip it out that people are working from home without under the direct, you know, literal supervision of managers or bosses, then do you know what I mean? It kind of goes back to what we're talking about, this kind of the purity of the work.
Yeah. I'm blanking on the name, but there's a gentleman who's written a series of really interesting books about where we are with productivity and with work.
David Graeber, the Bullshit Jobs one of them.
I know that one as well. I don't think this is the same person I'm thinking of, but I listened to an interview with him recently where he was talking about his next book is going to be about email, just solely about email. And again, talking about it for not. There we go. Yeah. Thank you. And his one of his lines is like, there is a good case for some people in organizations just not to have email. Just like, if I hire a web developer and I'm hiring them for their coding skills, I don't need people to have a means of interrupting them. I don't need something on their computer screen, which is where I need them to work, which is serving to take them away from what I want them to do. And when he was talking about that, I had been thinking for years about email and had we really sussed out a way of using it. And in my head, the size of the volume of email in a given day is just that. It's an index of distraction. It's an index of how much people are getting distracted by one another from often the underlying workload that the email refers to. I suppose what you might hear back from somebody who studied management in great depth or studied organizations is that there's a portion of work that isn't really assigned to anyone, that isn't really anyone's job, that has to be just kind of collectively absorbed by the organization. And one of the functions of big organizations and the kind of management structures you're referring to is to divert people enough of their time into that shared work that isn't easily divvied up into roles, to devote enough of their time to that it gets done or it gets serviced. You're asking about people, you know, whether physical interruption is going to be reduced if people are working remotely. And in a sense, you know, you'd worry that email would replace that, or that a lot of the online work tools. And just by the way, I mean, if you think like COVID is universally, economically damaging, and it's disruptive to so many businesses, but there are obviously some sections of, and a lot of big tech who are making a lot on their products becoming part of people's daily lives. So we need to watch the extent to which power is being further concentrated into those companies. But if a lot of work interaction is shifting onto those platforms, you know, you'd have to be wary about whether that's just going to replace some of what you might hope was reduced. But it's quite possible that people working in their own homes will feel more comfortable just shutting some of that off and shutting down and getting through a pile of work in a way that if you're, you know, walking in and out of walking around an office, bumping into colleagues, you have more cues to remind you of other things that you might be doing with your time. So it's possible that periods in the week of working alone or working in a concentrated space might help organizations get a better balance between deep work and that sort of more superficial, interrupty kind of work that you're referring to.
Because I think one of the other strange kind of paradoxes in a lot of this kind of modern work is we create new tools to solve existing problems. So, for example, people get a lot of emails, so we'll say, right, we're going to set up Slack or Microsoft Teams, and we're going to switch communications over to these new channels. But what happens is the kind of old channels still get used, so you just end up with more and more channels. So somebody will say, I sent you that message, and you go, well, did you email it to me, or did you send it on Slack, or did you send it on WhatsApp, or a Messenger, or was it a text? You know, and so you end up with just like 10 channels of communication that are all kind of binging and away at you, and it just kind of creates, what we kind of attempt to solve these issues and just create 16 more problems in the solving of it.
Yeah. Although I wouldn't ignore some of the opportunities that some of those different modes, I mean, so my problem with email is that it's not in any way opt-in. Like, you have to do a lot of work to kind of configure your email inbox so that you're only getting things that are germane to what you want to your kind of task set. Otherwise, it's just a way for people to access you. So, you know, a certain amount of I have some sympathy with the will of some teams to move on to platforms that are modeled like Slack and Teams, or kind of more modeled more on like web forums, I guess, where it's opt in. It's as many people as want to participate in a particular conversation can opt into it at a given moment, and the idea of having different channels and different things that you might take an interest in a given day, whereas an email is like, you know, is a constant need to change your focus. Group email threads can be really exhausting because, you know, once three people have responded to the thread, then everyone feels that they have to do a group response, and so on. But yeah, I think we're still, a lot of these technologies and the integration of them are still quite young. And some of them are really only being tried out for the very first time now that we've had to, as you said in your open question, in COVID. So I would still give it a couple of years and see if we can actually figure out what's the right use of email. So document sharing obviously is a big thing in my line of work in academia, where we're writing papers together. And a lot of people have been trying for a long time to move people onto shared folders and cloud, you know, doing editing collaboratively on the cloud rather than constantly updating emails and having to search back through versions and things like that. So a certain amount of opt-in, okay, there's a period where we're all kind of working on the cloud, but then there'll be a function where not everyone will have had the time to devote, so there'll be an email kind of roundup at the end of a round of edits or whatever. I feel like in a couple of years, we might be closer to integrating these different platforms so that each is being used for its correct purpose.
Yeah. Well, I suppose, I mean, the last question, maybe just to finish this off, is I think what we really need is for people to be adaptable, and the great mental health phrase is kind of resilience, essentially, isn't it? And because we are, I mean, we're still thinking a lot of these things through and we're still kind of discovering what works, and there's likely to be more changes. But in some ways, I know a lot of people absolutely detest uncertainty and they like, you know, kind of structure, but we may not have it for a while. So it's kind of it's like what a lot of people are doing in mental health generally is this idea of kind of increasing resilience.
Well, I think actually your other phrases of adaptability and kind of tolerance of uncertainty, I think those are definitely things where we can probably, you know, train and learn from one another. And just, you mentioned mental health in that question. I mean, I think mental health is actually a reasonably good example of where, I suppose, industry or the economy or the work space in general has actually adapted to a lot of new information in a relatively short amount of time. I mean, the awareness of mental ill health and people's mental health problems and I suppose the medical side of that, I mean, that's increased, that level of awareness has increased massively, certainly in the 10 years that I've been studying this, and I would imagine in an even shorter amount of time where there are a lot of more open conversations being had. And that's making people aware of not everyone being an equal unit. So when we're talking about, you know, productivity and people, you know, we do actually need to kind of ground ourselves in a social sense of one another as people and as individuals, and just to like have a greater tolerance of people having good days and bad days and having good moods and bad moods. And I think a lot of that information is making its way into the mainstream thought of a lot of organizations, and some of the organizations that I work with on projects are kind of saying to us in interviews and focus groups like that, this is new information, but it's good information. And some older staff are saying, it's information I wish we had when we started, and maybe we'd have been more aware, and maybe, you know, some people would have been able to stay on longer in work had they known how to cope with stress, or you know, maybe we'd be better friends with some of our older colleagues if we'd been able to manage each other, be more in tune with one another's emotions at an earlier stage. So I think in that broader sense of we actually are a really adaptable species, and I think Slugger is, or sorry, do edit that please. And I think COVID is quite a good example of like where we actually can adapt to really acute changes in circumstance and the environment quite quickly. So I would be relatively optimistic that we can develop a tolerance for a certain amount of uncertainty, as you say, just through exposure and just through practice.
Yeah, because as you say, I mean, humans are adaptable. That's why we have survived so long, yeah. I suppose.
While I would be very optimistic about that at the level of organizations and teams and individuals, what the challenge then is for society is for us as a society and for governments to be equally adaptable and equally flexible in their thought. Because again, going back to the start of the conversation, you know, people have been very concerned about economic impacts of COVID, but what COVID also does is change our sense of what the economy is. I mean, if physical proximity isn't going to be important anymore, then a lot of old knowledge and old conventional wisdom on what is, you know, what's good business, you know, location, 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 that equation has totally changed. Mm-hmm. So we need to also demand adaptability from the people who shape economic policy and think, you know, this is being framed as a recession, but really it's a new event in our modern economic understanding. And like, you know, if a meteor hit a football pitch and the commentator said, well, oh, that's going to be really difficult for Linfield now that there are three players down, you know, I think everyone in the audience would say, I think you're missing the bigger point. Yep. That a meteor has hit the football pitch. I don't think what happens in the rest of the football game is the most important thing. I think how we adapt to this new reality is the bigger picture. So I would think similarly about the people shaping economic policy and hope that, you know, that they can, you know, rethink what is like long-standing economic orthodoxy, so that as a society we can flexibly respond to this new challenge.
Okay, well, I think we'll leave it there. So that was Dr. John Moriarty from Queen's University Belfast. If you've enjoyed today's show, please subscribe and like it, and thanks for joining us.
The Sligro Tool podcast is sponsored by Queen's University Belfast. Researchers at Queen's are at the heart of supporting global efforts to understand the coronavirus. To discover more about their research, please visit qub.ac.uk.